It's the only workplace, the only occupation where, by and large, you are not paid, promoted, recognized, measured in any way having to do with your performance, only having to do with how long you've been breathing.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Stephen Brill, the author of Class Warfare, the creator of American Lawyer, content, Court TV, and your most recent foray into alternative media as well. Steve Brill, thanks for talking to us.
Happy to do it.
What's the rubber room and its significance to your critique of the educational establishment?
The rubber room was how I got into this and started thinking about this as a journalist, and it's really the tip of the iceberg. These were rooms set up in New York, formerly called the Temporary Relocation Center, or something sort of Kremlin-esque like that, where the rare teacher among the 75 or 80,000 public school teachers in New York who were actually identified as being the worst of the worst of the worst, just utterly incompetent or abusive to students, sometimes even they'd been charged with crimes. So under the union contract, they were entitled to long arbitration hearings as part of their tenure protection, and the arbiters would have to be approved every year by the teachers' union. And the contract said that they could only hold hearings on each case once or twice during a month. Long story short, these hearings dragged on longer than the O.J. Simpson trial, invariably resulted in some kind of compromise of the teachers being actually put back in the classroom after they got this 3 or 4 or 5 year rest in the rubber room.
And that's where they're just collecting their full pay and
collecting full pay and accruing pension benefits.
You've said that you read the union contract, you know, which is hundreds of thousands of millions of words long.
Yeah.
For fun, what are some of the egregious examples that you see that are carved out there?
Well, in Wisconsin, the taxpayers of Wisconsin pay teachers to go to the regional and state union conventions. In New York, a principal is not allowed to comment on the form or format of a teacher's lesson plan. The day is scripted out for a teacher down to, and I'm not making this up, the last 30 seconds. Typically, it's a 35 or 36 week school year. Why? God only knows. And in that 35 or 36 weeks, the typical union contract for teachers is they're entitled to 11 to 14 sick and personal days off. Do the math, it's basically a day off every 3 weeks. It's the only workplace, the only occupation, where by and large, you are not paid, promoted, recognized, measured in any way having to do with your performance, only having to do with how long you've been breathing.
Are these union contracts and problems, do those transfer to the suburbs? I mean, you talked about large urban areas. Outside of that, are the schools pretty good?
Some of them are good, but in the suburbs, the union contracts are typically not as strong, and the parents are stronger. The school systems are smaller, which creates its own set of economic problems with, you know, little bureaucratic, tiny little school systems. But it's not the same kind of problem. And there's competition outside the cities because there are enough well-to-do parents in the suburbs that they can look at private schools. The change that has spurred the reform that I write about in this book, one of the key changes is the growth of charter schools, thousands of charter schools. Some of them, 20%, 30%, are really well run, really well supervised by the school districts. And what happens? They prove that demography doesn't have to be destiny. There is a building that I write about in this book in Harlem where half of the building is a charter school, which is a public school. Taxpayers pay for it. It's free. The other half is a conventional public school. And the charter school, the kids are performing on their exams at a level equivalent to the schools in Scarsdale, which is a very wealthy New York suburb. On the conventional side, on the public school side, the kids are performing, unfortunately, the way the stereotype would have you expect that kids from impoverished, sometimes broken homes
and
in Harlem
kids are
perform.
From
yeah, this, it's same, the same.
So this is it's
the
like
same
the community.
Korean peninsula.
One system produces South Korea. One system
yeah,
produces.
It's like
North
you know
Korea.
When you fly yeah. over right. you know, Korea and you don't see the lights yeah. on in the north, and you right. see the lights on. Except it's even more significant than that because it's often. You know, there are siblings on two sides of the building. So the parents know. Now, the significance of that is in Harlem, as in New Orleans, when you start to have 25-35% of the school children in high-performing charter schools, then there's competition. All the parents know it. The parents demand that the politicians give them that kind of school choice. And that's what's really frightening to the keepers of the status quo. It's one thing to have a monopoly where everything is really terrible, but there's nothing to compare it to, and even if you could compare it, there's not anything you can do about it.
Talk about the role of technology. I mean, you have created time and again new ways of delivering media content, of opening up areas of discourse. Is technology the game changer in education? Is it actually a distraction? Is the idea of putting a computer in front of every kid a waste of time? How is technology transforming?
I don't claim to know enough about it in terms of cognitive skills and what works and doesn't work, but I have seen teachers at some of the really well-run charter schools be able to look at homework and give instant feedback on a tablet back to the kids, back to their parents, back to the teachers, supervisor, so the supervisor can see that night that the teacher's providing that feedback, just little things like that. The other real potential breakthrough is in distance learning. If you have, high schoolers who want to take advanced subjects, but there's just not enough, critical mass in that high school, maybe it's a rural high school, they can take that course online. Interestingly, again, the forces of the status quo conspire against that the way they conspire against the marketplace of choice. There are provisions in the union contracts in New York, for example, that require that a student, I'm going to paraphrase this, a student can't get credit for being in a classroom and learning unless there is a teacher physically present in that classroom, which is just crazy.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie. We've been talking with Stephen Brill, author of Class Warfare. Thank you.
Thank you.